The Capital Investment Committee for April 29th is called to order. Members, we do not have a quorum, and so we'll jump right into the agenda for today. First up, we have House File 3220, which is being heard on an informational basis. Welcome, Representative Green. I understand you have an A1 amendment for reference. Can you explain the A1 amendment and then proceed to your presentation?
Yes, thank you so much, Chair. The A1 amendment adds in American Indian Tribal Contract Schools into House File 3220 for consideration.
Thank you. Please proceed.
Thank you so much. Good morning, members. Representative Jeff Witte will be joining me shortly, but he is stuck in Texas right now, so hopefully he'll get over here shortly. So House File 3220 cancels the otherwise expiring balance, $1.8 million, in from the 2018 school safety grants, and it reappropriates the funds to a purpose consistent with the lawmaker's original intent. Fire emergency entry devices are on schools and in most committee member districts here. Knox box adoption is already well underway in Minnesota. We've got 66 school districts, including districts like Minneapolis, St. Paul, Rochester, Duluth, have already installed these secure key boxes, which is equal to about 180 school facilities statewide. Nearly 60 local fire departments are already using Knox boxes to ensure first responders can quickly access those schools during emergencies. So this widespread early adoption in Minnesota is aligned with what's nationally recommended for best practices for school safety, and it highlights Minnesota's proactive leadership in protecting students, something I think we all can agree on. So currently, Knox boxes are only accessible by fire departments. And welcome, Representative Witte. So currently, they are only accessible by fire departments. But what H File 3220 would do, it would create a mechanism to use existing funds to support one Knox box for law enforcement on every school in Minnesota. And it's enough funding to outfit all schools in our entire state. I'll repeat that. It's enough funding to fund all schools to outfit with Knox boxes in our entire state for law enforcement. So, as we know, every second counts in an emergency. In any school crisis, seconds can truly matter. A Knox box law enforcement key lock box gives police immediate access to the building's keys, allowing them to interlock schools within moments instead of wasting precious time breaching doors or waiting for someone to arrive with keys. This rapid access can dramatically speed up law enforcement response to stop the threat, essentially protecting students and staff. This is also supported by the National Safety Standards and Experts, leading safety authorities urging schools to install law enforcement lockboxes. The other thing is the U.S. Department of Justice's report on Uvalde, one of the horrible tragedies at Robb Elementary, explicitly recommends that all schools have lockboxes on all enforcements. That came out of that report. Two other partners that support this is the Partner Alliance for Safer Schools, otherwise known as PASS, and the I Love You Guys Foundation, which is the National School Safety Organizations. The schools in my district use I Love You Guys as part of our safe school planning. But they both advocate for deploying these lockbox systems. It's a best practice. And so what I'm going to do is I'm going to pass it over to Representative Witte now to give some expertise on what this actually looks like and how this works.
Welcome, Representative Witte. Please proceed.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Representative Green, for giving me the opportunity to sign on to the bill as a co-author, but also to explain the importance of this. For 27 years, as you all know, I was a Burnsville police officer. One of the programs I started was called Blue in the School, and it was building, learning, understanding, and educating at all of our elementary schools. And the reason that was so important was it's in our patrol districts, and you built relationships with the staff. You got to visit with the kids from kindergarten through sixth grade, but you also were there as a resource. So if something bad should happen at that school or get information. And one of the key parts that we did in Burnsville was we put some lock boxes after building these relationships and being a resource and seeing what happened at Sandy Hook, seeing what happened at some of these school incidents, that time and seconds, minutes matter. And we put the lock boxes in the back of the school, and it gave us access so we could get into the building without having equipment and other things. And you have to build that relationship. So this bill will allow every school to have that opportunity. When there's a school incident, most people are expecting everyone to come through the front doors where one door is usually unlocked. But this will give law enforcement the opportunity to get into the schools safely, quickly. And after Uvalde, we learned that it's important to get to the threat as soon as possible and not sit back and wait. So I appreciate the opportunity to talk about this bill. I think it has is a great way to provide safety in our schools.
Thank you, Representative Woody. Welcome. Please identify yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Peter Clough. I'm with the Knox Company. I live in Prior Lake, Minnesota.
Yep. Please proceed.
Chair, we have him here for questions or for answers, so I would like to open it up for members. So, thank you.
Members, any questions? Representative Frederick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is this a separate box for law enforcement than it is for the fire department?
Representative Green.
Thank you so much, Chair, and Representative Frederick for that. I'm going to pass it to Representative Woody to answer that.
Representative Woody.
So they can be dual, but fire usually had their separate ones, just in case a key would go missing, and then it doesn't do us any good when you're inside trying to go. So this would probably, my understanding would be separate for law enforcement that they can put in the rear of the building or wherever they choose. It doesn't have to be the rear, it could be a side entrance, but something different than the front. And so I think that's, if that answers your question.
Chair, can I add something to that?
Go ahead, Representative.
As well? Thank you so much, Chair. So the other thing is I think there's a liability issue too. And so when we have the fire department that has their boxes, and then we have the police department that would have their boxes. And, you know, it's very minimal maintenance at the school. But if a police officer were to access one of the buildings, like they are responsible for those keys, which are obviously really important, and they're connected throughout the whole system within a district. And so there's kind of a liability piece there as well. So I don't know if you wanted to add anything else as well.
Please proceed.
Yeah, I think there's several reasons. Location on the building, size of the box, number of keys put in. But probably the biggest thing is generally police and fire don't share the same key in within jurisdictions for liability reasons.
Thank you. So, you know, other questions? Closing remarks, Representative Woody, Representative Green?
Thank you so much, Chair. So, you know, House File 3220 is a really smart use of these canceling dollars. I'm aware of the budget constraints that we have this year. But this really aligns with the original intent of our Safe Schools grant from 2018 and respects the work of our former colleagues. But more importantly, I really believe that this bill would add a critical layer of protection for nearly 1 million students in our state. That's 2,000 public schools, 200 charter schools, our tribal schools as well, our intermediate districts, plus countless state staff in our state as well. So God forbid we would need it. I would sleep better knowing that it was there. So thank you so much for consideration.
Representative Woody. Thank you, Representative Green, for the presentation. Members, we do have a quorum now, and so we'll move over to the adoptions of the minute. Representative Allen, can I have a motion to approve the minutes?
I'd make the motion, Chair.
Allen, move approval of the minutes for April 24th. Any discussion? Hearing none, those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed say nay. The motion prevails and the minutes are adopted. Next up, we will have the two system. First up, we have the University of Minnesota to come and present their capital budget requests. Welcome, Vice President Roberts Davis. Please identify yourself and proceed.
Good morning, Chair Lee and members. For the record, I am Alice Roberts Davis. I'm Vice President of University Services at the University of Minnesota, and we are so excited to be here this morning to walk through our 2025 state capital request, and I'm also so proud to be joined by so many members of our Alumni Association this morning. Thank you for being here. As a public entity, we rely on the state to be a major partner in our work, and we know that our mutual success depends on it. The U of M system supports more than 75,000 jobs across the state of Minnesota, directly or indirectly, and our most recent economic impact study found that the overall economic impact of the university is $11.5 billion annually across the state. Our 2025 capital request includes two items. First, and our top priority, is HEPR. It's our main source of funding for facility renewal and upkeep. Reinvestment extends the life and functionality of our assets and continues to be the most cost-effective way for us to approach our assets. We have a long list of projects that we will tackle with $200 million, and many of these critical projects have been on our list for several years at this point. Our second request is the Future of Advanced Agricultural Research in Minnesota, or FARM, that would create a real-world teaching, research, and outreach farm in southern Minnesota to help farmers and industry meet this crucial moment in sustainable food production, and I'll talk about that more in just a moment. Our greatest need is regular, reliable funding dedicated to renewing existing buildings and infrastructure. We have old buildings, and we are learning that old buildings only create new problems. The majority of our inventory is over 50 years old, and things are really starting to fall apart. Buildings decay at a fairly predictable rate, and the problems do not go away on their own. We have about 8.8 million square feet of space that is now considered in poor critical condition, and that figure only grows every year. That's 8.8 million square feet of our 30 million square feet of space. We need a regular and reliable source of funds to solve this challenge, and with full funding of our $200 million HEPA request, we could fund more than 100 projects in 75 buildings across the state. State bond funding has become less predictable and more inconsistent than ever. The funds we receive are most often a combination of asset preservation and new capital projects, so there's often little focus on reinvesting in existing assets. There's also very little ability for us to predict either how much funding the university will receive or if we will receive funding, and so that volatility makes it almost impossible for us to make long-term project plans. We can't phase projects, and we can't plan for future years. Historically, higher education was the largest recipient of state bond funding. And to be clear, this chart focuses on all capital funding that was been provided by state bonds. But large capital appropriations from the state were responsible for constructing the vast majority of the university's buildings, but we have not received commensurate funding for the ongoing upkeep of those buildings. Higher education received as much as 50% of the bonding bill historically, and now we've received about 10% of the bill when one is passed. And again, that's shared with Minnesota State. The cumulative impact of sustained underinvestment has resulted in a 10-year renewal need of $6 billion. Again, about 28% of our space across the system is considered to be in poor critical condition. And with predictable funding and increased efforts to consolidate our space, we can really tackle and reverse this trend. So a lot of people think we're talking about buildings, but it's actually more than buildings when we're investing in HEPA. We're investing in the student experience and the facilities that students want. We do have to be competitive with other universities so that we can keep our top talent here in Minnesota. That's a long-term workforce reinvestment. And what we see happen is that when students choose to go to other states, they form relationships, they find jobs, they find other opportunities, and they tend to not come back. And what we want to do is keep our top talent here in Minnesota, and we can only do that by attracting them with the best facilities that are consistent with what they'll be using in the workforce and also consistent with the experiences that they've had in their K-12 education. I want to share with you one real-world example. Our HEPA request includes a long-overdue renovation of the Food Science Nutrition Building on the St. Paul campus. It's a 1956 facility, and it's home to a nationally ranked food science and nutrition department. The program is an absolute gem, but the building leaves so much to be desired. Students come here for a hands-on learning opportunity with lab work, product development, and real-world applications, and plant protein and food pilot plants. Sadly, the building is so outdated that we can't even install the latest industry equipment due to electrical limitations or offer pilot plant training when it's too hot or humid outside because the HVAC system just simply does not work. The building reaches temperatures of over 100 degrees in the summertime and really does hinder our ability to work in this building. Our neighbors at North Dakota State University, Michigan State, Kansas State, and Illinois have all made major investments in their food science buildings, and we will continue to lose food and agricultural talent if we don't match their modernized facilities. Students really need and expect to have buildings that will reflect the places that they'll work after graduation. When students choose schools with superior facilities, again, if they leave the state, that's a long-term workforce reinvestment issue. So now I'll talk just briefly about FARM. This is a $20 million request from the state for this project for the design. And FARM aims to deliver practical solutions for today and a forward-looking idea for tomorrow using cutting-edge technology like predictive analytics, big data, robotics, and artificial intelligence for farming. We would educate students, industry partners, and Minnesota farmers on modern approaches for agriculture and ensure a continued talent pipeline in this field. This is 1,300 acres that we've already acquired in Maurer County. We'd partner with the Hormel Foundation on this project, and it would be a study of the complete life cycle of agriculture from soil to how the soil impacts animals, how those animal proteins impact people, and how people impact the environment. And so we would love to continue with the design of this project so we can bring that project to fruition in the coming years. I always like to end with this slide and talk about how we put the funding to use from the state. When we do receive state funding, we put it to good use immediately. We're poised to do that again in 2025. Our track record has been to have spent about 90% within 2 years of the bill. As we reported to you in January, 85% of our 2023 appropriation has already been allocated to critical renewal projects, and our capital investments are great for the local economy as well, because about 90% of our expenditures go back to Minnesota companies. Thank you for your attention to my presentation. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Representative Scraba.
Thank you, Chair. As a graduate of NDSU and pretty active in student government when I was there, I actually went to the Capitol. They have a biennium, and their economy runs on the oil, on the price per barrel. That's how much money the universities, that's why in North Dakota there's brand new buildings all the time. It's, they have natural resource extraction, and they use that to their advantage. We in northern Minnesota, PUF funding, put about $70 million from 2010 till now. I'm just curious, have you guys worked with, and I know NRRI is working on it right now, which is an arm of you folks, perhaps working with permitting more mining and logging in northern Minnesota would bring you some of the funds you're looking for. Have you looked into anything like that? Thank you, Chair.
Vice President Roberts Davis.
Mr. Chair, Representative, thank you for the question. The PUF funding is all for university operations and ongoing maintenance of the different programs that we have there. I don't know that we use it specifically for HEPR. HEPR is something that we've generally relied on the state because these are state assets and state buildings that were built by the state, and so PUF funding generally does not go for the ongoing maintenance of our buildings. Thank you.
Representative Ryer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for your presentation. I probably have it somewhere, but is there a listing of the HEPR priorities by campus that would be useful to have? Thank you.
Vice President Roberts Davis.
Mr. Chair, Representative, thank you. I do have a list of HEPR. I'd be happy to leave a copy of that with you. It does identify the top projects for each campus, and it also identifies priorities depending on how much HEPR funding we receive.
You can provide it to Ms. Jenny Nash, and we'll make sure to share with the committee. Thank you.
Thank you.
Seeing no further questions, we'll move on to the next item of the agenda. Vice President Roberts Davis, we know that yesterday in the transportation bill, we had funding in there for the Washington Avenue Bridge. Knowing that, you know, in past previous biennium years, we have the discussion here that's a project that's eligible for funding through capital projects soon. So can you just give us an update on the Washington Avenue Bridge and just describe some what the project entails, and then members, we do have a fiscal note for all of you guys to refer to should you have other questions too. It's a draft fiscal note that we received. Please proceed.
Thank you, Chair Lee, Chair Franson, members, thank you. The Washington Avenue Bridge is a very busy bridge that straddles the Mississippi River and connects the east and west banks of the University of Minnesota campus. It is a double deck structure with a lower deck for vehicles and light rail trains, and upper deck for, believe it or not, approximately 20,000 pedestrians and 7,000 cyclists daily. It is a very busy bridge. Hennepin County owns the bridge, and the university maintains certain pedestrian level elements of it, including the enclosure, and we are also responsible for maintaining the lighting. Tragically, it's been the site of many mental health crises over the last 50 years, and we've had 2 deaths by suicide just this past fall. The pedestrian level of the bridge has safety railings, but they're low, and they're easily scalable, and they really need to be higher. We have been working on a design for the bridge railings. We have an opportunity to install a higher level railing that's not scalable, and we're working with suicide prevention advocates to ensure that we have the right design for that. And we know that studies show that there is a decrease in suicide attempts after those types of barriers have been installed. To date, the university has spent about $78,000 on temporary fencing that we installed in November. We've also issued another contract for $25,000 to ensure that we have the fencing there for at least the next 12 months, because we know that any sort of project that happens there will take about that long to complete. We are seeking financial support to install these life-saving barriers. We know how to build them. We're almost ready to go with it, but we do not have the funding. The estimate of the cost for the suicide deterrent barriers is about $8 million. It's a priority for us, and that would include the railings and the lighting. We would work through the process with Hennepin County in order for the approval, since it is their bridge, and we would get the necessary permits to do that. We know that we have to get this done. However, without funding for it, we are looking to the legislature or some other funding source in order to complete this project. And so with that, I'll stand for any questions you might have.
Chair Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Vice President Roberts Davis. I want to thank the university for the action taken last fall and getting the chain link fence up. I think it has deterred a couple of suicides since that point, and the leadership provided by the University of Minnesota is important. I also like that you've provided us with a timeline, and maybe I want to drill down just a little bit more. So let's say we pass a bill, gets signed into law, becomes available July 1st. Could you maybe just walk through the timeline of what would happen then and how quickly, and if there's any stages to try to provide a little more secure barrier as that construction is going on with that money.
Vice President Roberts Davis.
Chair Lee, Representative Hansen, thank you so much for your support on this. We anticipate that it's about a 12-month project because it is a quarter-mile-long bridge that needs railings on both sides. And so if we were to receive funding in July, we would complete the design. We would go through the approval process with Hennepin County. We expect that would take about 3 months, 90 days. We would be able to start construction hopefully in the fall. And then we would completely go down one side of the bridge. We would probably need about 4 to 5 months to do one side of the bridge. And then we would transition all traffic to the other side, flip that, and then do the other side of the bridge. And so we think that the bridge would be able to be functional for the entire time of construction, but it is probably about a 12-month process for the bridge to reopen.
Chair Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Vice President. So essentially the construction occurred during the school year, but likely maybe this time or in a couple months, it'd be at the end of the school year next year would be roughly completed if the funding was provided. Is that correct?
Vice President Roberts Davis.
Chair Lee, Representative Hansen, that's correct.
Chair Hansen.
And then Mr. Chair, and this is more of a process question for maybe Mr. Lee on fiscal notes. So I see the fiscal note here. It says date due to the legislature, March 12th. And I know with the Legislative Budget Office, there's been changes with how fiscal notes are done, but how this didn't get finalized. How can maybe you describe how that fiscal note was prepared?
Mr. Lee.
Mr. Chair and Representative Hansen, yes, this fiscal note worksheet is sent from the University of Minnesota. This is on a Senate file, and the fiscal note request by the Senate fiscal analyst was canceled. So it was not completed because it was no longer needed.
Chair Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. But it is, we do at least have a rough number, and the university has clarified the number, and that number is consistent with what we passed yesterday. Obviously, there's inflation and other items going on. So I think, you know, the reason we wanted you here today is just make sure we're in the range, that we can get this done, and that kind of the timeline, because it's a high priority, I believe, for both parties to get this accomplished.
So one question I have for you, Vice President Roberts Davis, I understand that in the past we were looking at potential HEPA dollars for this, and then with what you mentioned that this was owned by Hennepin County, is it still eligible for HEPA dollars too, if we should proceed that way?
Representative Lee, we were working with Minnesota Management and Budget for a special dispensation to use HEPA dollars because it is a public asset. We were going to use HEPA dollars because it's on the campus, but technically, is it HEPA eligible? Not 100%, sir.
Thank you. Seeing no other questions, thank you very much, Vice President Roberts Davis. Next up, we have Minnesota State to present their capital budget requests. Welcome, Associate Vice Chancellor Swanson. Please identify yourself for the record and proceed.
I think I've got the right cord in the right spot. Good morning. My name is Brian Swanson. I'm the Associate Vice Chancellor for Facilities with Minnesota State Colleges and University. I'm here to talk to you today about Minnesota State's request for facilities funding. We'll focus in this committee on our bonding request, but I would be remiss if I didn't mention at the start that we have two related requests in our operating budget. As you will see in a minute, we don't need any more space. We need better, and we need different space. Our operating budget includes two complementary requests, one for $25 million of non-recurring funding for demolition, and a second for $50 million of non-recurring funding for repair and replacement. You can think of this R&R funding as sort of the operating budget equivalent of HEPR. The $25 million of demolition money is probably the best money the legislature could send us this year, and I could say that we could spend twice that amount if you felt so inclined. Either way, funding for demolition is a challenge, and we hope that you can help us solve this problem. So back to bonding. At its core, this request is about providing some pretty basic facilities to serve the students that make up Minnesota's current and future workforce. For those of you not familiar with Minnesota State, we're the fourth largest higher education system in the United States, behind the State University of New York, the City University of New York, and the University System of Georgia. Minnesota State is an open access system. We welcome anyone with a high school degree or equivalent, and a whole lot of PSEO students from your districts. 38,600 first generation students, 56,000 low income students, and almost 7,000 veterans. We educate almost 2/3 of Minnesotans pursuing undergraduate credentials, as well as providing numerous workforce oriented non-credit certification programs. This diversity of programs, socioeconomic backgrounds, and demographics makes for an amazingly rich but crazily complicated set of facility requirements. You will find programs for landscapers, electricians, welders, surgery technicians, gunsmiths, accountants, computer scientists, artists, engineers, and nurses, from International Falls to Albert Lea and Moorhead to Winona. Minnesota has a history of making higher education convenient and available to all. The state universities, originally the teachers' colleges, the community colleges, and the technical colleges, grew up as three completely separate, uncoordinated systems. The technical colleges didn't even start out as being part of the state. They were built and operated by the local school districts. Higher education within 50 miles of everyone in Minnesota was the goal in the 1960s. The outcome of this idea of making higher education available locally has been what you see here. 28 million square feet of space, over 843 structures on 54 campuses. The challenge we face, not unlike the University of Minnesota, it's a math problem. Our facility-related expenses are growing faster than our resources. We've stopped adding new square footage and are trying to actually get rid of space, but what we have keeps getting older. As anyone who owns a house or a cabin knows, you can only get so many years, no matter how much maintenance you do, out of your roof, your furnace, your carpet. Eventually, it's just worn out. The roof doesn't magically fix itself, and it never gets cheaper. Buildings decay at a fairly predictable rate. You can see our backlog of deferred renewal growing at a very steady rate because the amount of funding we have to invest in fixing up buildings continues to go down in actual and inflation-adjusted dollars. The statewide network of higher education facilities was built largely by the legislature. Historically, the renewal and renovation of these buildings was also funded by the bonding process. State operating funds and tuition, the only other sources of funding available, paid for the operating costs, the maintenance, the custodial, and the utilities. These state funds and tuition, which have not kept pace with inflation, are not sufficient to fill the capital funding gap without decimating the very programs that bring in the tuition and provide the graduates needed by Minnesota employers. When expenses go up but revenues come down, our outcome has been that our buildings end up in worse and worse condition. So what do we know? Minnesota State colleges and universities are overbuilt for current and foreseeable need. Reduced state investment, rising inflation, tougher codes hamper our ability to keep up with deferred maintenance. There are insufficient resources, both capital and operating, to properly maintain and sustain all of our campus facilities. We need different space. We need better space. We definitely don't need more space. And more than anything, we need your help to replace, to modernize, and demolish. This leads us to our 2025 capital program. We're after competitive, modern, convenient, and safe facilities for our classrooms, laboratories, shops, studios, academic support, and student gathering spaces. And we need to do that through a combination of renewal, replacement, renovation, and demolition. Our 2025 request continues our no net growth approach. Since 2020, we've kept the growth of our academic space flat. We're actually hoping with your help to demolish buildings and bring the space total down. The $25 million in the operating budget I mentioned before will target 16 buildings and 500,000 square feet, but we've identified 1.3 million square feet of space that we could get rid of if we had enough money. HEPA is our number one priority. We have 65 projects across the system that will address critical needs at each institution. We also have 14 major projects, all of which you've seen before, and these are all renovation or replacement projects. Five of these you've previously funded for design. HEPR, Higher Education Asset Preservation Replacement, is a legislative created program set up in the early 1990s with some very strict rules about how the funds can be used. It's the most important bond funding you give us, but it also seems the first that gets cut in the development of the bonding bill. As you can see from these photos, these projects are not glamorous, but they're important. This funding renews building envelopes, your roofs and your windows, replaces plumbing, electrical, heating, cooling, and ventilation systems, resolves building code and accessibility deficiencies, improves energy efficiency, and upgrades utility infrastructure. Making these kinds of improvements early makes buildings last longer and reduces the need for whole buildings to be replaced. If HEPR allows us to make lots of small improvements, it's the line item appropriation projects that allow us to tackle larger and more complicated projects. I think we have available for you our 2024 bonding book. We saved some dollars and just stapled the new cost to the cover rather than reprint the whole book, but the projects are the same. In 2023, you funded design for five projects at a cost of $17.3 million. These projects have progressed through the schematic design phase and are now looking for construction funding. So there you have this. And so the full request is here on slide 14. We focus today on HEPR and the five projects that you previously funded for design. But if you have extra money and want to keep shopping, we've got everything on the list available to go. And then I know tomorrow you have an opportunity to hear about two of these projects more in detail. Presidents Peasley and Seymour from St. Paul College and Alexandria Community and Technical College will be here to talk about their projects in more detail. And then lastly, kind of as a final reminder for newer bonding committee members, when the state issues the debt for the full amount of a bonding project, with the exception of HEPR, Minnesota State pays the principal and interest payment for one-third. That's handled with Minnesota State a little differently than the University of Minnesota, which issues their own one-third. So here, for example, on a $24 million state project, it really only costs you 16, So you get a 33% off, which I like to think of as your triple Menards coupon. And with that, I'll say thank you.
Members, any questions? Representative Scraba.
Thank you, Chair. I'm Vice Chancellor. PSEO is in my district. We had a big conversation during Easter break because the schools are losing students to you guys, and the funding goes with it. And everybody's scratching, and, you know, I can see what's going to happen. There's going to be a big tug for these students at some point. Have you figured in any, if the GPA goes higher and you lose some of these students, does it affect your bottom line?
Vice Chancellor Swanson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Scraba, that would be a good question for somebody else.
Okay.
We welcome anybody in our buildings, and the more people we get, the better our food service does and our parking and everything else. So we like all to come and visit us, but I'm sure the academic side and the finance side would have opinions about PSEO.
Representative Scraba.
Yeah, and one, thank you, Chair. And one of the things when we tour the state and we go through all your facilities and we see what it does and the number of students and what's happening, again, I have no fault what you're doing. It's just that we need more students. We need to get more or consolidate. I don't know what we need to do, but something I know during our tours, we talk about it when we get back on the bus and we have our conversations about where's the future? What's going to happen? And because, you know, as much as this is for you, you know, we also have to make decisions. And we're trying to figure out what's the best, what is going to be the best in the future to keep these schools. Because every time I go to a function with you guys, you bring out the fact that you do support more minorities, more people that can't get to the university, you know, all that. You are the difference between families getting to their first education. So I don't want to diminish what you're doing, but at some point, how many of these do we need? And where are we going to go in the future? Maybe it's more of a statement than a question, but I know I've seen a lot of your projects. When you talk about demolition, I think Representative Hansen and I were at the where they're working on a tractor, and they couldn't get the tractor in the garage because the company donated a new tractor, but the garage was built in the 1980s, and the tractors got bigger, but the garage didn't, and the kids got to work on it outside. But that's what the industry is today. So, and you don't have the money to make the garage bigger. So I see it, I feel it, I sense it. I just, you know, how can we help you? Is there a new way? Have you guys thought about this? Because I don't want to see this Minnesota State go away. I mean, I just think about how many people, where they go. Rural Minnesota, even down in St. Paul, tomorrow we're going to hear from St. Paul, like you said, and we go to have breakfast there and get our watch all the kids and the people that go to school there. How can we help other than just this? Is there another plan that you've thought about? Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Vice Chancellor Swanson.
Chair Lee, Representative Scraba, can we give you a job? I mean, you're asking all the questions we are. how do we, when the facility costs keep going up and the revenues go down and we don't have enough to maintain it all, those are the same questions we're asking, is how do we make this work? And how do you maintain access and get the students who where higher ed is your first opportunity to change your family's trajectory? How do you keep that access but also maintain the facilities and the infrastructure? The math, like I said earlier, the math just doesn't work right now.
And I think to your point, Representative Scraba, that's a really great statement. I think that's something that we have been trying to have the conversation on in this committee about how do our operations, whether that's at Minnesota State or other agencies, and, you know, corrections is going to be before us later on to talk about how do we look at capital needs and the operations of the state for those independent agencies. So really appreciate that statement. Chair Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And mine is essentially a follow-up. You know, with the declining birth rate and with immigration restricted and changes in movement of inflow and out of people, does Minnesota need like a campus closing commission where it's not a decision made by the board, or is that something that we should direct the board to look at? Because we can continue to respond to each individual need at each individual campus, but it's not 1970 or 1980 or even 1990 anymore, and it's not going to be. It's not going to be. And so how do we essentially face reality for the future and maybe reinvest in places where, and also online learning wasn't there, you know, in 1970. So we have people attending classes that may not physically be there. So what, you know, I guess that's a specific question. Is this something that you would do, that the system would take on, or do we need to give some direction to the system, or should we just, you know, nobody's going to like to do that, but it is, our state has changed.
Vice Chancellor Swanson.
Chair Lee, Representative Hansen, I might punt that one up a level or two and say that would be a good conversation for the chancellor and the board to take up. I think the topic of campus closure would be a major, major discussion, and you should probably, I think it'd be good to talk to the chancellor about.
Chair Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, you know, and it's politically fraught, both for the system but also for the members. But I do remember, I see the university in the room, you know, that when Waseca was closed, probably 35 years ago. But again, the baby boom and the various echoes have echoed through, and the population has changed. And if, you know, I guess I would ask the board to have that discussion, you know, and come back. And because we did higher education yesterday, the operating existing, but this is the budget, this is the capital side. And we have to build, we have to update the buildings, we have to provide for the buildings. And so, and we have all the other needs. So is it something that on the capital side that the board could come back to us next year, or do we need to be doing something where we direct the board, or do we need to, nobody wants to close anything ever. And, but things have a beginning, a middle, and an end. And sometimes it's hard to face that.
See no other questions. Thank you, Vice Chancellor. Next up, we have the Pollution Control Agency's Assistant Commissioner Kurt Kadelka. And the Pollution Control Agency will be giving us an update on the PFAS removal report from January of 2025. Welcome. Please identify yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Chair and committee members. For the record, my name is Kirk Adelka. I'm Assistant Commissioner with the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. I have my colleague who will be helping me with more specific questions also introduce themselves.
Please identify yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Chair. My name is Fox Char. I'm a planning director and the agency PFAS coordinator at the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency.
Please proceed.
Thank you, Chair and committee members. We're here today to talk about a series of reports the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency did at the request of the legislature. We'll focus on the PFAS removal report. This is something that was requested, and it really focuses on strategies and how to fund PFAS removal from drinking water and wastewater sources. This builds off a 2023 report where we started to pull together information on potential information on where PFAS is being used to construct a fee program. The charge to the legislature to us was build on a conceptual level how the legislature could protect taxpayer funds through the removal of PFAS in drinking water and wastewater, and what would that fee system look like. And so what we built in the report is a menu and pieces that the legislature will have to make decisions on depending on which way they would go. We believe we've given you the information for the three foundational questions. One, who will pay, how to structure the fees, and what are the fee revenue targets. I do want to caution that there is, this is a very influx area. So information on users of PFAS is still uncertain. And so there are some things that are undefined, and we've highlighted those issues in the report. So we'll focus first on the piece of who will pay. The number of PFAS manufacturers, and we've defined that as those who manufacture, use, or release PFAS, so either they're manufacturing the chemical themselves or in manufacturing they're using the chemical. This universe is unknown. There is some uncertainty to it. We do have some information, which is detailed in the report, and we'll talk about that in a little bit, but depending on the reporting mechanism that you want to hook on the fee to, this could be anywhere from 1 to 10,000 companies. I'll give a brief examples here. For instance, under the chemical data reporting rule under the federal government, where those who are using 25,000 pounds per year, there's one company in Minnesota. Same with the toxic release inventory, which right now has just one entity reporting for the release of PFAS. However, some of these things are changing. A good example is the toxic report inventory. That was done when there was a de minimis, which really limited the amount of companies that had the report. That has since changed. The next reporting round should have more information as the de minimis was removed, because the small amounts of PFAS were underneath that. However, that is to be determined. In many of these cases, reporting data is just now becoming available on the federal level and may not be available for a number of years or be protected because of confidential business information. Other examples are the state has a reporting system that we're right now building for PFAS in products. We're completing that rulemaking. That's where we get the 10,000 number from. That is a number that we've used from information from Maine, who is also moving through this project of reporting on chemical intentionally added PFAS in products. We'll have more information. The first reporting date would be January 1st of next year, and we'd have more information at that point. However, things are changing. For instance, even reports under the federal government, as I mentioned, are changing, and so it creates some uncertainty there. The next one is how to structure the fees. Because of that uncertainty, one way would be to set a specific fee amount of X dollars per pound or per manufacturer. However, that would bring out a very difficult to understand the amount of revenue that would be accrued as a result. So it would be very difficult for the legislature to plan on how do you fund a program, how do you fund a project, if it's unclear what the revenue amount collected would be. So our best recommendation would actually be to set a specific fee target and then have that divvied up by a class of PFAS manufacturers. This is done in a number of areas. For instance, the dry cleaner account currently is done that way. The legislature has set $650,000 a year to be targeted, and it's split up by number of locations of dry cleaners or how much of certain chemicals they use. Or our hazardous waste permitting program sets by the legislature and the appropriation our program dollar amount, and then we split it up based on permit activities. It's much the same way that counties and others set levies. They set this certain amount of target, and then the property tax divvies that up between those who are payers. The legislature would need to set how they would want to do that criteria. You could do it a flat fee for all manufacturers on an annual fee, or you could base it on other things based on the reporting mechanism you want. This would provide a specific dollar amount if you were to fund, say, bonding payments for drinking water systems. That way, you would have the actual amount working with MMB if you need $100 million, $50 million for projects, what you would need annually, and make sure you hit close to that target based on the changing demographics of who is using PFAS. And so the next question is, what are those fee targets? The legislature asked for us to look at the removal of PFAS from drinking water and wastewater. And so we put in the report a number of recommendations on that. anywhere from drinking water to building PFAS treatment for the known areas of contamination for those public community drinking water systems, sampling private wells for PFAS, and then looking at those wells that have contamination and providing them treatment or alternative safe drinking water. On the wastewater side, we really look at source reduction. How do we prevent PFAS from going to a wastewater plant or a landfill? Both of these are PFAS conduits. They do not make PFAS. They do not change it in any way or use it. It is coming through them and passes through them into the environment. Money could be done for pretreatment systems, regional, that could be designed to capture the PFAS before it goes to a wastewater treatment plant and possibly destroy it. Or the most expensive is end-of-pipe treatment, which we do have some estimates here just for folks to look at. For instance, it would be $163 million about for community drinking water systems. That's about 20 systems, many of them that you have heard of from before. Sauk Rapids, Stillwater, the Hastings of the world. This number is actually probably low because this is a preliminary estimate. We have found with our work in the East Metro, our initial estimates tend to, as we get more details on them, become more expensive. If you wanted to sample just 10% of the private drinking water wells in Minnesota, that would be about $580 million. If only 2% of those had contamination, it would cost $7.3 million to provide treatment for them. The legislature also could provide a source of dollars to provide neighborhood hookups or other types of treatment systems. For instance, you could set that at $250 million. In terms of wastewater source reduction plans, we could estimate it could be anywhere from $7 to $85 million would go to wastewater plants to work with their users upstream to reduce the amount of PFAS that's coming to them. That is much cheaper than treating on the back end where you see the $23.3 billion cost to build treatment on the back end of a wastewater plant. In between is you could create for industries regional treatment systems. So a plater or a landfill could bring their materials to them, have it pre-treated before their wastewater goes to a wastewater plant or discharge it under their own permit. We have treatment facilities for petroleum and oil contaminated water. This would build the same thing for PFAS, although technology would need to do some more pilot projects in that to be able to build these facilities at the capacity needed. So in summary, the recommendations is to identify in statute who would be subject to the fee, based on various reporting data that is available at this point. Then set a overall PFAS fee revenue target, which would be determined on what you are looking to build, whether it's programs or specific projects. And then finally, more information on how you would like it divided up amongst those fee payers. Is it a flat fee if you have any preferences on small or big businesses, smaller or large users? That would be another policy choice. So, Chair and committee members, thank you for the time. We hope this information is helpful as you continue to deliberate on how to address the great needs I know this committee and others have had about PFAS and the treatments.
Thank you, Commissioner. Chair Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Commissioner Kudelka. The series of questions on the manufacturing. And so we're using PFAS here as a very broad definition, the definitions the legislature had. Did you look at more commonly having a different fee structure among more commonly used or more commonly found versus less common, less found, or more toxic, less toxic?
Commissioner.
The chair and committee members, it's a great question. We did not get to that level of detail. There's still more information that has to come through us and reporting mechanisms to be able to really distinguish that. In addition, we're continuously learning about PFAS. What was once thought to be probably maybe less of a risk is now the same risk. A good example is we always focus on PFOA, PFOS, the long chains. We were told, well, the short chain stuff, a new generation like Gen X, not a problem. We have now found those are just as toxic as the PFOS. So we haven't gotten into that detail. That would be very a difficult analysis too, especially when we're looking, as you mentioned, the state definition is up to thousands of chemicals to do that analysis. Our Department of Health has risk values for just a couple handful of chemicals. That would require much more detail, that type of study to be done before to set that those different rates based on the chemical risk profiles.
Chair Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Commissioner Kudelka. So there's no naturally occurring PFAS across the board. So somebody makes it, right? There's a manufacturer that makes it, and then they sell it to other companies to use. When you're describing a manufacturer, are you describing only the people who make it and then sell it, or are those people who make it and use it within their company?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair and committee members, for this effort in the report, we used manufacturer, those who make the chemical, and those who use the chemical and products they make. The reason is there are very few number of PFAS manufacturers, only one that we're aware of in Minnesota, which is starting to move away from that and transition away from it. But it is still coming into the state from U.S. and other international sources.
Chair Hansen.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, and I'm trying to approach a nexus here of where would you levy a fee if there's only one manufacturer and they stop making it, but if there are people who are buying it elsewhere and then they're making a product that includes it, we would be able to, there has to be an amount. Let's say you're making a waterproof suit that whoever makes the suit has to purchase and use a certain amount of PFAS, whatever chain, to make that waterproof. We would be able to identify that because they would be having to purchase it and have their recipe on how much they use.
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair and committee members, at this point, we don't have that information. We may in the future. The federal government is doing a report backwards looking, and our PFAS reporting rule will do it forwards looking if it was intentionally added for products sold in the Minnesota. So we could do it that way. The difference between manufacturers and manufacturers that use it is the use of PFAS has just as much risk, if not more, in Minnesota because we have releases, whether it's to surface water or groundwater or to air, from that use that we have found to be issues. An example is plating companies that had sent it to wastewater plants. And so they are the source of it and have as much risk to the environment as the manufacturers of the chemical.
Mr. Hansen.
And I would assume the workers who are handling it and have to be processing it, there would be risk immediately to them as well. Would that be correct?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair and committee members, correct.
Chair Hansen.
Mr. Chair, then finally, I want to go on the back end because we hear a lot of proposals. PFAS, whatever the forms, or PFOAS, PFOS, is unable to be destroyed in putting it through a traditional electrification plant, whether it's a coal-burning plant or whether it's a wood-burning plant. Is that correct?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair and committee members, I'm going to ask my colleague here to help. The destruction technologies and the study of them is continuously moving forward, and we'll try to give you the latest right now.
Please proceed to answering the question.
Thank you, Chair members. Yes, is the short answer to your question. The currently available destruction technologies that would be used at a typical wastewater treatment plant cannot handle the destruction of PFAS. There are some promising technologies that are being looked at, but none of them have been proven at a facility scale. Many of them are kind of small scale pilot projects still. Some of them are occurring in Minnesota as well. Supercritical water oxidation, for example.
Please identify yourself again for the record.
Thank you, Chair. My name is Fox Char. I'm the agency PFAS coordinator at the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency.
Thank you. Chair Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And when we took the last tour in the bonding committee in the previous session, we visited Woodbury, and we looked at these large tanks that had an aggregate material on them. My question is, those are not destroyed on site. They have to be hauled to a high-intensity incinerator in Ohio. Is that correct, or somewhere else?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair and committee members, Woodbury and the East Metro communities are looking at a couple different technologies, either granular activated carbon or ion exchange, and those are just removing PFAS from the drinking water. Correct. They are not destroying it. They have to go to another location, and the contractor may either landfill that or send it to a hazardous waste incineration location.
Chair Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So when we talk about removal, we're not talking about destruction. It's a filter, whether it's in a traditional. You think like a coffee filter, but it's not that. It's aggregate, and that has to go somewhere.
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair and committee members, correct. The first step is the removal, and then, as my colleague mentioned, there are technologies being looked at, whether it's incineration or others, that on the effectiveness of destroying PFAS.
And a final question, Mr.
Chair Hansen.
We have no location or site for a hazardous waste incinerator in the state of Minnesota. Is that correct?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair and committee members, correct. There is not a hazardous waste incinerator in Minnesota.
Representative Sexton.
Good morning, Chair. If we could return to the slide, we were talking about $7.3 million for private wells. Can you give me an idea of what the technology is to mitigate that, as well as what the cost would be?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair and committee members, thank you for the question. I just want to note that this is an estimate based on just some projections. The technology that would be used for at-home treatment would be a granular-activated carbon systems. It would be a two-vessel systems. They're about $2,500, $3,000 to install and should be exchanged probably every year at about $1,000 or so. That's the cost that we, as a state, under state contract, occur. And that would do, as mentioned earlier, it would remove the PFAS, and the media would have to be addressed elsewhere.
Representative Sexton. Commissioner.
Mr. Chair and committee members, correct, with those type of systems. In some areas where we have a number of homes together, we would rather connect them to a municipal system. If the municipal system is not contaminated, that way it has upfront costs, but the ongoing operation costs are not there.
Thank you. Representative Scrawa.
Thank you, Chair. Commissioner Gadelka. Trying to go down where Representative Hansen is going down, y'all call it a fee. I'm going to call it a tax. Either way, the idea is to make the manufacturer, the people, and that's where my question, where Representative Hansen was going, is. So if I'm making the PFAS, am I paying the fee? And if you're making the plastic part from the PFAS, are you also paying the fee?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair and committee members, it would depend on how you define the universe of PFAS manufacturing. For instance, if you use the chemical data report, which is one, that is likely 3M. That is the manufacturer of it in Minnesota.
Yep.
If you use a report such as anything on its use moving forward on products, it would be both. And so it really... Defining the universe will help you define that way. The manufacturers who use it as part of their process are a greater pool than those who actually just make PFAS.
Representative Scrava.
So this is just for new, for ongoing use of PFAS. This has nothing to do with that's already been manufactured. Is that correct?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair and committee members, most of the reporting systems do look forward. There are some that look backwards if you wanted to use that as a template to set a fee to start with. So it depends, but correct, most of them are looking forward or their use at the time. So if someone were to stop using PFAS, they would not be subject to the fee any longer.
Representative Scrava.
And so if you're a manufacturer and, because, I mean, the ultimate goal here, from what we know what PFAS do, I think that the goal is to eliminate them or try to. Again, because this is the way we live our life, this thing listens to what's going on. And the other day I got a feed for soy product replacing fire protection PFAS. They're proving that this works. And it's like, where'd this come from? You know, but, and my point is going to, if you put a big enough fee, then the manufacturing might stop because there might be a better way to do this. And if the goal is to eliminate these, wouldn't that, and how far, you know, and this is where I get in the weeds because I don't quite understand, like, does DuPont need this for their Gore-Tex if this is what we're talking about? And it has no bearing if it does or not. I know nothing about it, but the Gore-Tex is very popular. I like it. I use it. It's a great product. But if it's doing that much damage to our environment and to us. Maybe there's something better out there. And if we put a fee big enough, then it quits becoming part of the problem. But if we're saying, eh, you can use it, we're just going to put a little fee on it, are we saying it's okay then? Or are you going to take the fee is going to be the cost to remove it from the cycle? Is that how you're trying to figure out the cost of this fee? Thank you, Chair.
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair and committee members, you bring up a very important issue when setting up the fee, is that under Minnesota law and other states now too, by 2032, intentional use of PFAS in products will be prohibited unless a currently unavoidable use designation is assigned to it. So we are looking into the future where the potential fee payers, if you set it up, no matter what the universe is, would shrink separate of the fee. As you mentioned, you could use the fee as a tool also to set policy decision to move folks away from and transition away from it. So that is a challenge in setting up any program, and it is something that would be good to think about as building this, and depending on how you want to fund things and for how long.
Representative Scrava.
And where my first concern came when I was reading this, looking at it, is so you're going to set up a fund, a fee, the fund, to fix this, and then it goes away because everyone quits using it, and now was that the goal, or was the goal to set up the fund to help clean up what we have? So that's where I'm somewhat confused. What is the ultimate goal here to do? Because I could go into a million things, but is that what is the purpose, or what was the purpose? Thank you, Chair.
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair and committee members, I think that will be one of the questions the legislature should pose itself to. What is the purpose? The charge given in the report is funding the removal of it from drinking water and wastewater, and we propose those items. It could be used as a signal to move away from PFAS and source reduce. The intentional use of PFAS in Minnesota is prohibited in 2032 unless there's currently unavoidable use. We don't know how many that may be, 0 to 10 or whatnot. That rulemaking is still going on. So that is an unknown at this point, and unfortunately we won't know that until a future date.
Right. Thank you, Chair.
Yeah, and Representative Scrava, I think to your last question, as one of the author of the report, just looking at the cost for wastewater treatment up to $23.3 billion, and that's why we wanted to take a look at this. Is this something that's sustainable for us? And, if we as the state cannot pay for it with, just the funding that we have right now, we need to look at alternative funding mechanism for this type of treatment. Representative Scrava.
Thank you, Chair. Again, all this stuff, what goes through my brain is we're working on this canyon project up in northern Minnesota, trying to collect all the old landfills, put them into one, to collect the PFAS so they're not leaching, and then you collect them, and then what do you do with them? XL Energy says they're at a 99.9, we can burn them, and maybe that's a pilot project, I don't know, but there's all these things that are happening and occurring around our state and trying to, and then we know that there are wastewater facilities that are still letting the PFAS through and are going into our waterways. And they're so big, it's such a big deal that you can't just stop it. And we've identified it. I mean, that's good here. Some of the unintended consequences, what my concern is like, can we just step back and look at the unintended consequences that have happened? A ATV for a kid, you can't use it if you're a child because there's PFAS in it, because our rules that we did. And it was like, was that the intent? No, the intent is to keep small toys from their mouth, not something they can ride, So how do we, before we get to, and I'm concerned about the fees, where do the fees start and stop, and when does it start? When do these fees start? So thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Representative Scrava, and I really appreciate that, and just want to say thank you to the MPCA. In the report, I think this is mostly more for us to consider what are the decision-making points that we will have to make sure we move forward with this proposal, and so really appreciate the feedback that you have before us, and should we have any proposal, I think this will be heavily debated in the legislature as we move forward. Thank you. Next on the agenda, we have the Department of Corrections to come and present on the governor's revised recommendation Welcome. Please identify yourself and proceed.
Chair Lee and members of the committee, my name is Safia Khan and I am the Deputy Commissioner of Corrections. I want to thank you for giving DOC your time today. Commissioner Schnell wanted to be here himself, but he is currently meeting with victim families ahead of today's parole hearings and he sends his regrets. So to start off, on the screen is a quick overview of DOC's capital investment priorities for this year. Earlier this year, you heard from Commissioner about the Rush City project in great detail. This project remains unchanged and fully funded in the governor's revised recommendation, so I will not be speaking to it again today, but should you have any questions, we are always happy to answer them. Next, the governor has included significant investments in asset preservation dollars, as well as $9 million in general fund cash in his budget request for the DOC. And lastly, you will see that there's a new proposal requesting $1 million for space consolidation and strategic planning studies in the revised budget recommendations to help DOC develop long-term strategies to address its aging prison infrastructure. The studies we are requesting will be focused on the Stillwater Prison. As many of you know, the Stillwater Correctional Facility is one of the state's oldest prisons built more than a century ago. Its continued use in 2025 does not reflect resilience, but a growing liability. The conditions within the prison have declined to a point that compromises safety, efficiency, and operational integrity. The 2020 Safety and Correctional Facilities report issued by the OLA was clear that Stillwater Prison presents significant security and safety challenges. The prison has staggering deferred maintenance and high operating costs, and it is not the matter of if this prison needs to close, but when and how we close it. We believe that continuing to invest in the upkeep of a crumbling facility like Stillwater is an increasingly inefficient use of taxpayer dollars, like putting patches on a sinking ship. Recognizing this, we are requesting $1 million in general fund cash to complete two studies to help us and the legislature thoughtfully plan to ultimately close the Stillwater Correctional Facility. First, a decommissioning study to determine how the state can responsibly and strategically decommission the physical infrastructure and provide options for what the state can do with the buildings and the land. This includes environmental assessments, historical preservation, site reuse planning, and potential redevelopment options. And second, a management study to guide the operational side of vacating the facility, everything from labor management to the logistics of relocating incarcerated people. I want to specifically say this. This is not a proposal to permanently close the Stillwater Prison. The DOC does not have the authority to do that without explicit legislative approval. This proposal is to allow us to conduct the necessary studies to bring back information to you, the legislature, to make those decisions as thoughtfully as we know you would like to, and to ensure we don't continue to kick this can down the road anymore. So why Stillwater? We believe Stillwater has been on hospice for many years and presents the most risk out of any of our state correctional facilities to the state due to its condition. Many, if not all of you, have toured Stillwater either in bonding tours or at our tour for new legislators that we held this past winter. You will remember the dangerous five-tier living units, poor sight lines, outdated manual locking mechanisms, and lack of climate control. Conditions that not only challenge safety for our staff and the residents, but also impact the morale of all those who work and live in that facility. Our workforce at Stillwater is resilient, but as we look to the future, we need to consider the reality that the Stillwater Prison is crumbling. Since 2020, the Department of Corrections has spent $8.4 million on priority asset preservation at Stillwater. And still, it accounts for a staggering 25% of DOC's total deferred maintenance needs, totaling more than $180 million. So why not renovate or replace Stillwater? When looking at replacement versus closure, the numbers paint a clear picture. In response to the 2020 OLA report, the DOC contracted through a third party for a study to estimate the cost to fully renovate or replace Stillwater Correctional Facility. A handout summarizing the results of the study are in your materials. The report estimates that the immediate safety and security needs alone at $113 million and concluded that the cost of renovation is prohibitively high. And if the facility were to be fully replaced on the current site, it would cost the state around $1.35 billion. So, chair members, as those of you who have been on this committee for years know, year after year, the DOC requests tens of millions of dollars in asset preservation to help us make a dent in our deferred maintenance needs. and we are thankful for your recognition of our needs and the investments that you have made in our state prisons. However, despite these investments, our deferred maintenance numbers keep growing. We're not alone in this regard. Across the country, many state legislatures, DOCs, and governors are dealing with similar situations. Florida, Virginia, Connecticut, Pennsylvania, Kentucky, Illinois, Nevada, and most recently our neighbors in Wisconsin are just some of the states who have or are planning to close aging facilities. The studies we are proposing are the first step for Minnesota to develop a long-term plan to significantly decrease the strain on state resources. And we really appreciate your consideration of this request. Mr. Chair, I would like to now turn it over to DOC's Capital Resources Director, Carl Hunt, to discuss our asset preservation request in further detail.
Welcome. Please identify yourself and proceed.
Chair and members of the committee, my name is Carl Hunt. I'm the Capital Resource Administrator at the Department of Corrections. I will be touching briefly today on DOC's asset preservation request, as you heard us describe in our need in greater detail in an earlier hearing. As you can see from these images, this is just a small sample of the deferred maintenance inside Minnesota's prison facilities. These and other photos included in this presentation present a tiny fraction of the ever-changing needs across our agency. The DOC is responsible for maintaining and operating 11 facilities that encompass a total of 336 buildings and more than 7.5 million square feet, most of which are in constant use 24 hours a day, 365 days of the year. Within these environments, over 4,300 staff and 8,300 incarcerated individuals live and work every day. This nonstop use places massive pressure on the system, contributing to the DOC holding 33% of all deferred maintenance across the state agencies, the total of $733 million. The chart below shows a powerful visual representation of this fact and the large portion of MCF Stillwater and MCF St. Cloud represent in that total state agency need. Recognizing this, the governor's proposal includes $44 million in GO bonds as well as $9 million in general fund cash to our non-bondable asset preservation needs. Many non-discretionary critical safety and security needs, such as security control system upgrades, fence protection system upgrades, and security camera upgrades, are not eligible for bonding dollars. These investments are crucial to maintaining safe and secure correctional environments and ensuring the continued operation of these vital state assets. Continued capital investment into corrections is key to preventing future increases in deferred maintenance. It will allow the Department of Corrections to continue fulfilling its mission while ensuring that our facilities remain secure, operational, and well-maintained. Thank you, and Deputy Commissioner Kahn and I stand for any questions that you may have.
Thank you. Representative Sexton.
Good morning, Chair. If we can go back to page four. Slide four. I noticed the nice round numbers for the management study and the decommissioning study. How'd you arrive at those numbers?
Mr. Hunt.
Chair and members, we consulted with Department of Administration, Real Estate and Construction for those numbers, based it off some similar things, Veterans Affairs and other agencies that have been through. And we also consulted with a different division of admin on the professional technical side of the house and just went through different scenarios. It's a large undertaking to get through those studies. The scope is large.
Representative Sexton.
Nothing further.
Seeing no other questions, just want to say thank you, Commissioner and Mr. Hunt, for bringing this forward. And I think to some of the larger discussion that we had earlier with Minnesota State, really appreciate the leadership of the commissioner for having the foresight to really take a look at our assets to see if, you know, if this is really good for us as a state moving forward or not. And so I just want to say thank you for that. Chair Franson, I actually have a question. Chair Franson.
Thank you. And so this is a rumor I heard, so I'm glad to see that, because I've heard the rumor and I'm like, I don't know, I haven't heard anything. But now to see that this is a possibility, where would the employees be transferred to? What's the plan for that? What I don't want to see is a bunch of unemployed state workers trying to find employment.
Commissioner.
Yeah. Chair Franson, Shirley and then Chair Franson. That's one of the number one concerns that we have too. And what we are currently looking at is how many staff do we currently have at Stillwater, and that number is around 576. We do have that management study. We would have it look at where those staff could be relocated to. So our nearest facility would be Oak Park Heights, which is about 2.5 miles away. We have Lino Lakes, which is about 27 miles away, and then Red Wing is about 44 miles away. We also have our Shakopee facility in the Twin Cities. So we would look at who all is retiring from their ranks in the next year or 2 years or 3 years. We would look at where those spots are available in similar classifications at those other facilities, hold them so that those people could potentially get transferred over. And we do have enough retirements and other moves coming in our officer ranks, et cetera, that we believe that we could accommodate a vast majority of those staff in other prisons across the Twin Cities.
Chair Franzen.
Chair and members, if I may, I just want to emphasize that the request is for a study, and that as the study continues and evolves, the items that we will discuss, and the end of the study will provide direction and options for future leaders to discuss.
Thank you. I see no other questions. Thank you so very much for coming by today.
Thank you.
Members, that concludes our agenda for today. Tomorrow, Chair Franzen will have the gavel, and the meeting is adjourned.